Yeah, everybody, I really stopped in the middle of a point. The question that we were talking about at the end of yesterday was that there are two different Machtos HaShekels that appear in the Torah. One is the annual Machtos HaShekel that is given for the Karbanos. That's every year. And the other is a one-time Machtos HaShekel that was given for the construction of the Mishkan that was melted down, that formed the sockets that held up the krashim, held up the boards. And that is said to be an atonement for the Chet HaEgel, an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. And the question, you'll recall, that we ended with was, if that's part of the Mishkan, why is that the only part of the Mishkan that has to be uniform? Every other part of the Mishkan, you gave what you wanted to give. Gold, silver, copper. You gave as much as you wanted to give or as little as you wanted to give. But here, everybody has to give a half shekel to be melted down for the Adonim.
Yeah. What did everybody say is a kapar for the Kategon?
The Adonim, the half shekel that was melted down for the Sakit. So I began telling you a vort from Rabbi Meir Shapiro. I didn't tell you the vort. I told you a few stories about Rabbi Meir Shapiro. But now let me tell you the vort that he said to explain this idea. You know, he came to America. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of the world-famous Yeshiva of Lublin, which is still standing in Lublin. He was the founder of the Daf Yomi program. Unfortunately, it's just a Jewish museum. It's not a yeshiva. But, you know, they have it's a museum, and they have a nice, beautiful shul, which nobody ever uses other than when there are visitors. But I think when they made a Siyam HaShas, they actually did a Siyam HaShas there to kind of honor his memory. But he came to America to raise money, and it was hard to raise money. So he made the point that, you know, it's a funny thing that everybody knows this, that people are much more willing to contribute to a building than they are to an operating budget. In other words, I'll give money to put up a nice building, I can put my name on the building, etc. But, on the other hand, so many yeshivas may not have a building, but rebbeim aren't getting paid, there isn't money to feed the students sometimes, that's not the situation here, but and the like. And how come it is? I mean, in truth, what is more important? In truth, what goes on in a yeshiva is much more important than where the yeshiva is housed. What is important in a yeshiva? The learning, the Avodas Hashem. What is important in a shul? Not the beauty of the building. It's good to have a beautiful building. That's a way of honoring Hashem. But it's not that important, ultimately. What's more important is the kavana of the tefilos, the devotion. And yet, people are much more willing to pay for buildings because buildings are tangible, buildings are visible, etc. So, here's what Rabbi Meir Shapiro says. When it comes to building the Mishkan, God didn't have to tell people how much they have to give, because people will naturally want to give to have a beautiful Mishkan. But what are the things that they may not give on their own? They may not give for the operating budget. That's the Karbanos. That's like the Rebbe's salaries. And they may not give for the sockets, because the sockets are the foundation. It's like the undramatic. Remember, the Adonim, if you can visualize the Mishkan, the Adonim were actually not visible, because what happened was the tapestries that covered the roof of the Mishkan and went down along the walls actually hit the ground, meaning to say the sockets, which were one amma from the ground, right, the silver sockets, you had the wooden beams and the silver sockets, but the outside observer would never see the beams or the sockets, because they would be covered up by the Urios. So Rav Meir Shapiro says, something that people do not naturally want to support, God has to give a minimum contribution. So Rav Meir Shapiro was making the point that the Adonim are extremely important because they are the foundation. But because it's not so noticeable, people would not naturally give. He was making the point, yeshivos are also the foundation of the Jewish people, and therefore one has to be willing to support them, even though it's not as dramatic as a building or the like. In fact, the Talmud Yerushalmi, Masechet Shkalim, has a very, very interesting discussion about this peripherally. Two rabbis were walking somewhere in Eretz Yisrael, and one rabbi pointed to a magnificent shul and said, "Look at the beautiful shul." This is after the destruction of the temple. "Look at the beautiful shul that my grandfather built." And the other rabbi said, "Look at how many people starved because your grandfather built this beautiful shul." It's a fascinating type of question. You see the issue here. On one hand, it's a mitzvah to glorify Hashem with beauty. This is called Heder Mitzvah. The Mishkan itself was beautiful. The Beis HaMikdash was beautiful. This is based on a verse in the Song of the Red Sea. We say this every day. Zeh Keli V'Anveihu. This is my God and I will glorify Him. This is called Heder Mitzvah. There's a mitzvah to have a nice lulav, a nice esrog, not just a kosher one, beautiful tefillin, beautiful talis, beautiful siddur. All of this is very good. But the question then becomes, when you put your money and your resources into beautifying, then that means there's less money that will go to support Torah or to help poor people. Right, so the debate between the two rabbis, and really it's not a question of one is right and one is wrong, it's just a question of a person has to weigh this carefully, is one rabbi was saying it's such a wonderful thing to glorify God by a magnificent Beit Knesset. And the other rabbi says, well yeah, but don't forget that by putting all the money into a beautiful building, what were you doing about the poor people who didn't get food and the like? So one has to prioritize. I'm not giving you an answer as to how to do it. But the point basically is that this is always the dilemma in life. That something in the abstract may be a wonderful thing to do, but you always have to ask yourself, what is it causing me to give up? And by the way, it's not only in money. We're using money today. But the same thing is true in all Avodas Hashem all the time. When you want to adopt a new chumrah, a new stringency, and you can say, well, that's a wonderful thing. You're trying to serve God with more fervor, with more enthusiasm, with more commitment. But as Rav Dessler writes, human beings only have a limited amount of energy. And it tends to be when you focus your energy in one area, there is going to be usually less energy for something else. So something is going to go. And what is that thing that's going to get weakened because you're strengthening yourself in this other area? So for example, a person might take on a certain chumrah that they're not going to eat a certain thing or whatever it is. Now that may be a proper thing to do. But if it results in anxiety, in anger, in being short-tempered with one's wife and children, then it's not a good thing to do. Because the energy you're putting into this new optional thing is taking you away from things that you have to do. Right? It's an important cheshbon, it's an important shikol, that you can't just look at whether something is good or not good. You have to look at what will it push away, what will it set aside, what will it weaken. And sometimes it might very well be that even something that in the abstract is a good thing to do, if it will weaken or push aside something else, which is more important, then it's not the right direction to go. Okay? Generally speaking, almost any chumrah, I'll speak to the married people for a moment, almost any chumrah that will interfere with your shalom bias is, and you have to ask a rav, is usually not a good idea. It's not the right chumrah to take on in your life. A chumrah that will interfere with your learning, with your davening, is not a good chumrah because it's taking away from the things that you have to do. Okay, so this is what Rav Meir Shapiro said, that since the adonim are foundations and they're covered up and they're not visible, people would not naturally gravitate to give it, and therefore the Torah has to require a minimum donation. But for the visible part of the building, people would give anyway. And therefore, there's no need to require minimum donations. That was Rav Meir Shapiro. But there's another teretz that is given. And here is the following. Again, I said some of this Friday night, so again, forgive me. And that is, there's an important thought that Rabbeinu Bechaya says. Rabbeinu Bechaya is a Rishon who wrote a very great Perish on the Torah. Some people pronounce it Rabbeinu Bachya, some people say Rabbeinu Bachai, and others say Rabbeinu Bachaya, so we're not sure exactly how to pronounce it. Apparently, it was a common name in Klal Yisrael, although today I'm not aware of anyone that has that name, so for some reason, I don't know, it's a name that's dropped out. Just for your own information, there are two Rabbeinu Bachayas that are famous, and they're different people. The author of Chovas HaLevavos is Rabbeinu Bachaya Ibn Pakuda, and the author of the commentary on the Chumash is Rabbeinu Bachaya Ben Asher. They are not the same. So when you say Rabbeinu Bachaya, you have to know you're talking about the Chovas HaLevavos or the commentary on Chumash. They are two different people who lived 200 years apart. Chovas HaLevavos was earlier than Rabbeinu Bachaya. Chovas HaLevavos was before the Rambam, and Rabbeinu Bachaya was after the Ramban, so it's two or three generations later. Be it as it may, Rabbeinu Bachaya in Chumash says a very interesting point, and here you have to trust him. He says that if you count all of the commands connected with the construction of the Mishkan, building the Mishkan, there are 613 commandments. I don't mean in the whole Torah, I mean about do this, all every detail of the Mishkan, there are 613 details. Now we know that there are 613 commandments in the whole Torah. And we also know that the commandments of the Torah correspond to a person's limbs and sinews. For example, the 248 positive commandments correspond to my bones. Every positive commandment gives life to my bones. Every negative commandment is connected to your sinews or your ligaments. To say, in other words, that when you violate a negative, you're impairing your muscles or your tendons. Well, now, we don't know exactly what that means. Obviously, that doesn't mean in an absolute physical sense, because you can have plenty of good runners who are not religious or believers in God. But in some spiritual way, the vitality of even the animal soul of a person is impaired in a significant way. Now, the Mishkan is a metaphor for bringing Hashem into your heart. That's why the Pasuk says, V'yasu li mikdash. Hashem says, make for me a temple, make for me a sanctuary. V'shachanti b'socham, so I will dwell in your midst. So the same way that the way I build a temple to Hashem in my own life is through the 613 commandments. The 613 commandments make my soul and body and soul a Mishkan, a dwelling place for God. So too, the Mishkan itself has 613 commandments connected to it, which are the ways that you bring the divine soul into the Mishkan. Meaning because the Mishkan parallels making myself a Mishkan for Hashem. Now based on this, the following. The Torah could not have said everybody should give the same towards the Mishkan. Because when we build ourselves to be a Mishkan for Hashem, every person builds a different Mishkan. The Mishkan is not supposed to be the same. Every person has different talents. Every person has different abilities. Some people have gold, and some people have silver, and some people have copper, and some people have blue wool and scarlet. Hashem does not want sameness in the tabernacles that we create with our lives. Hashem wants us to serve Him with individuality. Hashem wants us to serve Him with distinctiveness. That within the common framework of Torah, we serve Him with the special qualities that we have. So that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu could not mandate a fixed, definite contribution from every person when it comes to construction of the Mishkan. Because by definition, every Mishkan is supposed to be different. And that is why when it comes to the Mishkan generally, everybody gives based on their abilities and talents. But there is one part of the Mishkan that must be uniform, and that is the foundation. It's So the concept is, each of us builds our own temple in our own way, but the foundation has to be the same. And the Adonim represents the foundation, and I'll talk about what that foundation is, and that's why it's uniform, meaning every part of the Mishkan is different except for the foundation, which is uniform, that basically says Hashem wants us to be individuals, but we share the common goal and aspiration of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the whole concept of tribes, right? Why are there tribes? We talked about this before. Tribes. Now, today a tribe is not a big deal because we don't even know our tribes unless you're a Kohen or a Levi. But tribes in the Torah are a big deal. Reuven's land was separate from Shimon's land. There was a separate Nasi. There was a separate flag. There was a separate part of Eretz Israel. A separate place in the divine camp. Now, at first glance, you might have the impression, why are tribes even important? We're a Jewish people. Do I need to introduce another source of disuniformity? Hey, I'm a Reuben, you're a Shimon. You know, my tribe's better than your tribe. Why even have that? Why don't you just say, everybody descended from Yaakov is Am Yisrael, and those who joined by conversion. But there's a very, very profound lesson in the notion of tribes. Because every tribe had a unique personality. Every tribe served God in a different way. Yisachar served Hashem through the learning of Torah. Zevulun served Hashem also by learning, but primarily by supporting Yisachar, by being engaged in commerce. Now, we don't clearly know the distinct quality of every tribe, but Yaakov Avinu in his bracha tried to capture uniqueness. So what is Hashem saying by tribes? I don't want conformity and sameness. I want individuality. I want uniqueness. I want every segment to find its own special pathway. But within that diversity, there should be common purpose and goal. So that is why every part of the Mishkan is different. You're not supposed to be the same as the other guy. But the foundation has to be uniform. Now, to elaborate on this a little bit more, what is indeed the foundation of life? So here, there's a very interesting Gemara in Makos, at the end of Makos. The Gemara in Makos says that there are six, that, you know, Moshe, Hashem gave Moshe 613 commandments to give to Bnei Yisrael. Two of them we actually heard from God directly, and the other 611 Moshe told us from Hashem. But then it mentions, the Gemara says, that future generations were not able to fully keep in mind 613. That's too many things to keep in mind. So later generations kept on reducing them to fewer and fewer and fewer commands. Now this doesn't mean, the Gemara doesn't mean, of course, they took mitzvahs away. No mitzvah was ever taken away. But it means that they were characterized and gathered together under some fundamental ideas. So instead of thinking about 613 ideas, we were able to get all the 613 under 15 categories. I think about 15 ideas. And the Gemara goes through a whole bunch of numbers, 15 and other numbers in between, and then it goes down to 3, 2, 1. So I want to talk about 3, 2, 1. Right? I'm not going to go over all of the other categories. So as the Dairis get weaker and weaker, and as the Dairis are less able to comprehend so many different ideas, the great Nevi'im tried to reduce the 613 to fewer and fewer principles so you could wrap your head around it and try to understand it. So the Navi Micha, one of the great Nevi'im, this is before the destruction of the first temple, got everything down to three things. There are three things that God asks of us. This is actually a very famous pasuk. This is on the entrance of the National Archives in Washington. What does God ask of you? There are only three things He asks of you. Asos mishpat, to do justice. Avas chesed, to love kindness. V'hatsnei leches im Hashem Elokecha, and to walk humbly with your God. Okay, this is the whole Torah in three principles. Do justice, asayis mishpat, avas chesed, love kindness, hatsnei aleches, walk with Hashem with humility and modesty. Those are the three principles of Micha. The Navi Yeshayahu, who was a contemporary of Micha, reduced the three principles to two. Shimru Mishpat. So instead of Asais Mishpat, Shimru Mishpat. Shimru Mishpat means guard justice. Asu Tzedakah, and do charity. Now we'll see, Habakkuk got it down to one, I'll get to that. But right now I just want to focus on the three and the two, because it's some interesting discussion here. Micha had three principles. Yeshayahu had two principles. So first, which principle fell out totally? The third one of Micha. The third one of Micha was walking humbly with God. Yeshayahu took that one out. Why is that? Okay. Second question. The first principle is very, very similar. Micha said, Asos Mishpat, to do justice. Yeshayahu changed it slightly, Shimru Mishpat, to guard or preserve justice. Close, but there's a difference. The second principle survived, but with some major surgery. Micha said, love kindness, love chesed. Yeshayahu said, do charity. So let's analyze the differences between the three of Micha and the two of Yeshayahu. Again, if you're going down, that reflects a Yerida. The generations are getting worse and worse. So here is Yeshayahu's concern. Micha says, do justice. Go out and do justice. Take care of the people that you've been taken care of. But do justice assumes I know what the right result is in any given case. Right? In other words, a person might think he knows what justice is, and he will go out and do it vigilante-like, or the like. For example, you might think Reuven is cheating Shimon, so you go to Reuven, and you take his property and give it to Shimon like Robin Hood. But in fact, maybe Shimon is in the wrong and Reuven is in the right. And you've robbed Reuven. So what Yeshayahu is saying is, before you get into the business of doing justice, be sure you're not committing an injustice. Do no harm. Shimru is a negative term. Shimru means preserve justice. Meaning, don't become a do-gooder until you know for sure that you're not doing an injustice in the course of trying to be just. Meaning, sometimes our message to a crusader is just stay home and don't interfere because you don't know what you're doing. Now, second principle. Micha said to love kindness. Love kindness. In the ideal situation, when I see somebody that I could help, even if it's a major inconvenience, I should be so happy that I could help them and be excited and joyous that I can help a Jew. It's not just doing chesed, it's loving chesed. And that's a high, wonderful madrega. But what if I'm a person? I don't enjoy it. I consider it a bother. I consider it a trouble. So Yeshayahu has a fallback position. Even if you're not a person who loves chesed, you can at least write a check. Give tzedakah. Doesn't say love tzedakah. Remember, chesed is different. Chesed is what you do with your body. Tzedakah is what you do with your money. So it's a yirida, meaning ideally I should love to do chesed. But Yeshayo says, even if you don't love the chesed, you can at least do the charity. And it's kind of an inferior fallback position. Now, what about the omission of the third one? The total omission. Micha said, walk humbly with God. That's an important thing. This is a very, very important pasuk. People think the word tzinius refers to the length of a woman's skirt or her sleeves, and they make all of tzinius a concept that only applies to superficial external dress. Now, of course, there are halachas about that, and they have to be followed. But tzinius, in its essence, is not about externals. It's about a certain inwardness, a notion of reticence, of modesty, of humility, of not being ostentatious, of not parading your relationship with God, of treating it as a private, precious thing. And ideally, as the prophet Micha tells us, one's relationship to God should be a private, treasured thing, not necessarily to be advertised, not necessarily for people to see. Because when we do things and people see us, there is always the taint of the gaiva and the arrogance of showing off. All of that is true. So now the question is, why does the Navi Yeshayo take it away? He takes it away. Because here is the thing. He is alluding to an important idea. As vital as it is to be modest and reticent, as the generations get worse and worse, you sometimes have to be a bit more public and demonstrative. Meaning to say, sometimes you need to daven in a public place so that people will see. You need to learn Torah when you're sitting in the airport or the bus station so people will see, a Jew learns Torah. Meaning to say, I don't mean to show off, of course, but the concept that I don't want people to see me doing mitzvahs is a good ideal in theory. But it sometimes has to be compromised so you can be a role model and a source of Kiddush Hashem. There is a time in which we need to be a bit more public about our observance of the Torah to either indirectly inspire others to follow that example. Now, of course, if you do it in a rude way, you've done exactly the opposite. You've destroyed things. But I'm talking about in a way that is not a way that infringes on other people or hurts other people, or, you know, as they say, there are ways in which when people do mitzvahs publicly, they can actually make a chilul Hashem, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, in a menschlich way. Now, I'll give you an example. Rabbi Saul Salanter, when he was a young man in like 1840s, he was very attracted to a way of life that existed in Lithuania, not too much today at all. There were tzaddikim who were literally hermits. They were hermits. They would leave their families from Sunday to Shabbos, only come home on Shabbos. They would live in isolation, without a minion really. But all they would do, 24 hours a day basically, I mean whatever amount they had to sleep, too few hours, they would pray and daven and learn. Many of them were great Kabbalists as well. And they perfected themselves, and there was silence. They would not exchange a word with anyone else for an entire week. And Rav Saul Salanter was very attracted to this. He saw this as a way of attaining holiness through solitude. And this was a way of serving Hashem without public recognition, without acclaim, without fame. He saw this as very, very powerful. But he eventually concluded that this is not the way of life he could follow. Because in a generation, this was in the 1800s, where so many were so far from Torah, he didn't have the right to concentrate on his own spiritual growth without caring about others. He had to be in the public eye. He had to be someone that was teaching, that was demonstrating, that was showing mitzvah. Because that was his responsibility to God, and that was his responsibility to the Jewish people. You know, and imagine this, you know, I knew a person who, he was Shomer Shabbos, but he was someone who didn't learn Torah at all. He just didn't learn it at all. It wasn't what he did. And he once told me, this is really unbelievable, that his father was a great, great Talmud Chacham. He found out after his father died, his father was a great Talmud Chacham. But his father never learnt in front of the children. Why is this? Because the father was so humble, he didn't want his children to see him learning. So in front of the children, he only read the newspaper. And only when the children went to sleep did he learn for the whole night. So imagine this, a person who was so righteous that he didn't even want his children to know that he was someone who learned. Is that good or is that bad? Now you could say, wow, what a modest, humble person who truly tried to serve Hashem with modesty and humility. He didn't want his wife to know. He didn't want his kids to know. But you see the problem. His wife, his kids never see him learning. What are they going to think is important? So you as a parent have to be a little gaibadik almost. Say, look at how much I learned. Follow my example. Right? You have to kind of, you know, say, this is what I do. I daven and I learn and I do mitzvahs and I sing zemiros. You got to be a leader, right? If you're a parent, you got to be a leader. At least within the family structure. Right? You can't allow the modesty and humility, which is such a wonderful quality, to basically say, well, if my six-year-old doesn't want to learn today, well, you know, who am I to tell a six-year-old what to do? You know, he's just as good as me. He's better than me. You know, you can't do that. So that is the inner meaning why, as wonderful as Hatsnei Aleches is, as the generations get worse and worse, you got to be more assertive, a little more public. And that explains the transition from 3 to 2. But we'll end here. I just want to say that there's one more transition from 2 to 1. Even 2 ideas were too much to handle. And the Navi Habakkuk reduced the 613 principles of the Torah to 1. Can't do less than 1. Negative numbers don't work here. And that 1 principle is tzaddik b'emunaso yichya. A tzaddik lives by the emuna that he has in God. If you had to come with only 1 principle, the Gemara in Makos says emuna, knowing that God is your creator, that God is the one that providentially directs every aspect of your life, that he loves and cares about you both as a member of Am Yisrael, as an individual. If a person internalizes emunah, number 1, they have the serenity to withstand no matter what life gives them, because they know there's a purpose, they know there's some good in it. They don't get arrogant when good things happen, because they know that Hashem gives it to them for a reason. They don't get broken or crushed when bad things happen, because they're confident in divine love. And when you have emuna, you want to know what is God's will. You will learn the rest of the Torah, because if I know that God is the one that's giving me life and taking care of me, I want to do what I can to serve Him. So Habakkuk says that the foundation of the whole Torah is emuna. And to go back to the Adonim, that's why the Mefarshim say that everybody builds their own Mishkan, but the foundation has to be common. That's the Adonim. The foundation is Emunah. In other words, it is Emunah that is the common foundation for the multiplicity of endeavor that each of us does. Okay, we'll continue a bit more about this, but this is the basic message.